Okay, let's get started again. Question already? I haven't even spoken yet, Arthur.
Sir, we were just discussing here.
What are you discussing?
About the you're denying the Trinity and salvation.
Yeah.
We were just thinking, the second statement, it's very crucial, Arianism, that if you deny it, you're denying Christ as God, then it will really affect the salvation.
Definitely.
Yes, but the other statements, it will not necessarily affect the salvation.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah. Yeah, so modalists, it's still possible to be saved. Arians, no. Yeah, because you're denying the full divinity of Christ. Yeah. Cool. Okay, we're going to transition to church history. Lessons from history. We're starting it. It's the beginning. Everybody have the notes? Yeah? There are two kinds of people in the world. People who love history and people who hate history. How many people here, I just be honest, raise your hand, say, I love history. Okay? That's good. Now, honest, raise your hand. I do not care for history. Jerome, you're neutral.
Yeah, I don't love it. I don't hate it.
I don't care for it.
No, I don't hate it. I don't love it.
Okay, everybody here in this class that doesn't like history, I'm going to tell you why. Because you never had me for your teacher. If you had me as your teacher, you would love history to this day. Most people hate history because it seems irrelevant. A friend of mine, Stephen Mansfield, do you know Dr. Mansfield? I think he's been here. The first book he wrote, it's called More Than Dates and Dead People. It's about history. But for most people, history is just dates and dead people. Got to memorize all the dates, got to learn about all these people who are dead. But history has a completely different approach when you look at it from God's viewpoint. So, our outcome-based objective, the goal of this course, is to provide an introduction and foundation for systematic theology, so that we're more grounded in the truth and able to lead God's people through the many challenges facing us. I love history, I read history all the time. And I love church history, but the main reason I teach church history is for our theology class. Because theology did not happen in a vacuum. It developed in a historical context. And if you get the historical context, then you'll grasp the theological understanding. So we have to do church history alongside of theology to give us a good framework. Okay? Proper view of history. A proper view of history is essential to interpret the facts of history accurately. The facts of history accurately. You see, every worldview interprets history differently. But they all have to answer three primary questions. There's three primary questions about history. Is it cyclical or linear? Is it random or purposeful? Is it optimistic or pessimistic? So we'll look at three different views of history. There's the Eastern view in the Asian world, primarily. The Eastern view of history. History in the East is primarily cyclical. It goes around in circles as opposed to having a starting point and an ending point. Eastern philosophy, Eastern religion is a big cycle. Reincarnation, life is just a constant cycle. It's not a starting point and an ending point. just going around in circles. And so history has no real beginning and no real end. It's just cyclical. Patterns that just repeat themselves in never-ending cycles. The Darwinian view, which is the Western view, is linear. There was a starting point in secular thought. What's the starting point of history? The Big Bang. And there's an ending point. What's the ending point?
Apocalypse.
What? Do you know anybody with a science background? Huh? Yeah, they call it heat death of the universe. Heat death. When all the available energy has been used and burned out. There's no more energy left, and the universe dies. So, linear, providential, and that's the view of the Bible, providential is linear. It has a beginning. What's the beginning?
Creation.
Yeah, and God said. And it has an end. What's the end?
Second coming.
Last judgment. Yeah, which is kind of just the start. Doesn't actually have an end. Just various different ends. Now, Eastern view of history, it's sort of random, but it is purposeful also. The goal in history in the East is what? What's the goal? Nirvana, yeah. To escape the cycles. And yet, it's random in that who knows when it will happen to you. The Darwinian view of history, it's random. Why is it random? Why is history random in the Darwinian Western view?
No God, no selection. No one controls.
It's all based on time and chance. Time and chance. So everything that's here is here just because we had a long time and just random chance. Accident. Now, the providential view of history, it's purposeful. It's really true to say that history is his story. There's a God behind the events of history. They have meaning. Eastern view of history, it's pessimistic. Because even when you get to nirvana, you know what nirvana is? It's the dissolution of personality as you merge in the cosmic universal oneness. I mean, that's nothing too exciting to get out of bed for. Darwinian view, of course, is pessimistic, but it's the heat death of the universe. Again, nothing much to look forward to. We might as well eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. But the providential view is optimistic. It's a glorious future that we're heading towards. Now, why is it important to study church history? Church history shows the gradual execution of the divine plan of redemption. Church history shows the gradual execution of the divine plan of redemption. In the scripture, we see the plan of redemption begun. Church history is how it's being lived out. Church history, number two, is the key to the present condition of the church and the guide to her future. It's the key to the present condition of the church and the guide to her future. Deuteronomy 32, it's just listed there, but I'll quote it for you. It says, I won't quote it for you. Oh, I will. Remember the days of old. This is what Moses says. Remember the days of old. Consider the years of all generations. Ask your father, for he will inform you, and your elders, and they will tell you. I told you I'm reading Martin Gilbert's biography of Winston Churchill. Gilbert is the official biographer of Churchill. His authorized biography, his full biography, is 32 volumes. He's dedicated his entire life to the life of Winston Churchill. Churchill appointed him as his official biographer before he died. And he spent his life studying the life of Churchill. And it's a life that you could create 32 volumes out of. The volume I'm reading is a condensed one volume. I mean, it's 1,200 pages, but it's just one volume. A condensed version of the 32 volumes. And it's a completely fascinating study. I just returned, before we came here, I returned from a vacation in England, and I had my youngest son and his wife, and we visited Blenheim Palace, which is the ancestral birthplace of Churchill. It's a pretty big place. It's 300,000 square feet. Let's see, that works out to, what is that? That's 30,000 square meters. It's massive. They say no one's ever been in every room. I can imagine not. I love studying his life. He's an amazing person. It's just turned 1942 now in the biography. And he's, when Hitler began to come to the forefront in the early 30s, all of the Western nations tried to accommodate him. It was Churchill, he was the only one that saw the danger. And he began to challenge and speak against Hitler. Actually, as a result of speaking against Hitler, he lost his political clout. He actually lost his job, lost his seat, and he was sort of banished from British politics because of his vehement, continual stand against Hitler and being aware that what he's headed towards. Of course, Churchill was the only one that was right. Everybody else was wrong. And it's interesting that we have some of the writings of Hitler, some of his communique with his staff. And Churchill was the only person that he was afraid of, because he was the only person that really understood what his ultimate goals and his aims were. And when Churchill finally came to power on May 10th of 1940, he said, and he was 65 years old, he said, "My entire life has been a preparation for this day." And he said the reason why he was able to see so clearly what was happening and what was going to happen is because all his life had been a student of history. It was because his understanding of history, he could see right through Hitler. He said, "We've seen this before many times in history." And he was aware. And because of that, he probably saved European civilization. Probably saved it. He said about history, he said, "The greatest advances in human civilization have come when we recovered what we'd lost, when we learned the lessons of history. We cannot say the past is past without surrendering the future. The farther back you can look, the farther forward you can see." What a great statement. The farther back you can look, the farther forward you can see. Church history is the key to the present condition of the church and the guide to her future. And number three, church history is a treasury of warning, encouragement, and counsel. Every age has a message from God that we have to understand. Job said, "Ask the former generations and find out what their fathers learned. For we were born only yesterday and know nothing, and our days on earth are but a shadow. Will they not instruct us? And will they not tell you? Will they not bring forth words from their understanding?" In this section, we're looking at the apostolic church. We're starting in the year 30 and going to the year 100. And we have to look backwards first. Preparation for the church age. Paul wrote this, but when the fullness of the time had come, God sent forth his son. Can I get a little bit more volume back there? I'm starting to lose my voice because I'm straining it. And I wonder if I could hear myself a little bit louder. I wouldn't have to strain. Thank you. This is my third straight day of all day speaking, so I want to make it to the end. Thank you, that helps me. So when the fullness of the time had come, God sent forth his son. Paul understands that God had been working in the world to prepare the world for the coming of his son. God prepared the world, first of all, politically for the advent of his son. He was preparing the world politically. The Romans provided a united empire, the rule of law, and relatively secure travel. When you look back at the history in preparation for Christ, more than three centuries before the birth of Christ, a man comes to the forefront, a man named Alexander the Great. Have you heard of Alexander the Great? A man who had a strong sense of his destiny. His father was Philip of Macedon, and there's a story told about Alexander when he was just a teenager. His father was returning from a war where he had had victory and conquered an enemy, and Alexander wept when his father returned, and he asked him why he was weeping, and he said, "I'm afraid that there'll be no more worlds left for me to conquer." He felt from an early age that he was destined to conquer the world. I think we're getting a lot of feedback, aren't we? Yeah. I need volume, but not feedback, if that's possible. I think the problem is we put those Bose speakers right underneath the speaker. So he wanted to conquer the world, and he finally got his chance. At age 20, he came to the throne, and he conquered the modern world, essentially. He died at 33. He only was in power a little less than 14 years, but he pretty much conquered the known world. I mean, he couldn't go all the way to India, but he conquered most of Europe. And one of the things he did, he'd been discipled by Aristotle. He'd been trained by Aristotle. So he was fascinated with Greek language and Greek culture. And so everywhere he went, He brought Greek culture and Greek language. Now, when the Romans come and the Romans take over Alexander's former territory, they add their part to it, but the Roman Empire in the first century is essentially Greek in culture. And so you know what that means is there's this vast area, everybody spoke Greek. There's a common language. Now, do you know how important this is for the advancement of the gospel? Language barriers are one of the biggest cultural missionary barrier that we have. One of my friends, Matt Rash, went to France, planted our church in Marseille a few years ago. He had to take 2 years to learn the language before he could go. You know, that's a lengthy amount of time to really be prepared as a missionary to go to that culture. In the first century, everybody spoke Greek, at least as a second language. And so that barrier is broken down. Could you imagine if Alexander hadn't converted and every little community's got their own little separate tribal dialect? The difficulty of advancing the gospel. But God had prepared the world for the gospel, so there was a common language, there was a common culture, a common way of thinking, because it's not just language, it's culture. You know, one of the reasons I've been able to be effective here in the Philippines the last 5 years is not only because you all speak English, and that was God's providence, but that we have somewhat of a shared culture. So we can communicate with one another culturally because of that. That's God's providence. Now, on top of that, so of course Rome comes in, and Rome, the main thing that Rome was interested in, Rome is interested in commerce. Rome is about business, okay? So Rome wants to conquer, they want power, they will let communities have their own puppet ruler as long as he establishes and maintains what? What? No? What? No? Peace. Yeah, order. As long as they keep order. Because the Romans are interested in order. Why do they want order? Huh? So business can take place. So they're about business and commerce. In order to have effective business and commerce, you need lines of communication. You need transportation. And so they set about creating a whole massive system of roads. The Roman roads. And the Roman roads are still in existence today. I rented a car in England and I drove. Most of the main roads that I drove on were built on top of the former Roman roads. We stayed at a little place out in the Cotswolds in the West Country. And the road that I drove up was an original Roman road that was built. And it's one of the straightest roads in the world. Over a distance of almost 200 miles, it never gets over 5 degrees off of a straight line. I mean, this is engineering done in the first century. Amazing roads. All of the motorways in England follow the original Roman roads. All throughout Europe, you can still see some of the Roman roads are still there 2,000 years later. I mean, they built amazing roads. And they built walls in the northern part of England. Hadrian, who was an emperor in the second century, he built a wall from one ocean to the other because he wanted to keep out the Scots, the precursors of William Wallace. That's my ancestry. My middle name is MacDade. I'm a Scotsman. My grandparents were Scottish immigrants that came to this country. And the Scots, especially the northern tribes, they were never conquered by the Romans. And so they built this wall, this massive wall to keep the crazy Scots out. And I've walked on top of that wall. It's still there in existence. They built these amazing structures. Along their roads, they were perfectly flat and straight, and they had mile markers all along the way. You can still see Roman mile markers. Not only did they build roads, but they patrolled them, because it's no good to have roads if you've got bandits. And so prior to the Romans coming in, the paths and the various different roads they already have, they're filled with outlaws and bandits. The Romans start patrolling them, and you can have safe travel. Not only do they do that, but the Mediterranean and the various different seas are filled with pirates. So what do the Romans do? They get rid of the pirates. Travel in the first century would never be that safe again until we get to the 19th century. Travel will never be that safe again in Europe until the 19th century because of the Pax Romana. Have you heard that phrase? The Roman peace. They brought order, but what they did is now we've got a unified empire, we've got a unified language, we've got a system of roads and transportation. The world was prepared for the gospel. God was providentially at work setting things in order so that when his son came, the gospel could go out. And, you know, there's substantial evidence that the gospel went as far as India in the first century. Substantial evidence. All throughout Africa, Europe, certainly the Romans came, they established a port on the northern banks of the Thames. They called it Londinium. It's now the city of London. The gospel had come to England before the apostles Peter and Paul had been martyred. And that's a huge difference, distance, if you think of Jerusalem to England in the first century, and yet the gospel was able to spread like that because of the Romans. So the Romans prepared, or God prepared the Romans for the gospel. But not only that, number two, God prepared the world spiritually for the advent of Christ. This fascinates me. At this particular time in the first century, there's about 1 to 2 million Jews in the area that we would call Palestine. There was probably 6 to 8 million outside in other parts of the Roman Empire. That's what we call the diaspora, the dispersion. And the Jews, when they went out to the Roman Empire, they built synagogues because they couldn't do temple worship, so they built these synagogues. And what's happening in the first century is the old pagan gods have really failed the people. There's a skepticism that's come in. People are starting to doubt all of those old gods. Are they really true? I don't know if we can believe them or not. At the same time, there's a mass exodus to the cities. The cities are beginning to grow. And what's happening, people are leaving their old family ties and they're going to the big cities. And so there's a feeling of displacement, of needing community, wanting to get anchored in, of rootlessness. And so what's happening is massive numbers of people are being attracted to the Jewish synagogues. Here's what they like about the synagogues. The idea of one God, monotheism, is very intriguing and fascinating. And so they're attracted to the idea that there's this one being who creates all things and owns all things. Another thing they loved about the Jewish community is there was an ethic. The Jews were the most trustworthy people. You could do business with them because their word was gold. And that was very appealing in a world where a man's word meant nothing. But the third thing that was intriguing to them is in the cities, of course, first century, there are no social services whatsoever. But the Jews had their own system of social services. They cared for one another, and they cared for people who came and were involved in their synagogues. And so here they see this community of people that are caring for one another, that there's integrity and moral uprightness, and they had this one God they worshiped. So there's a mass number of people that are being attracted to the synagogues, and they're called God-fearers. But there are two primary issues that are stopping them from becoming full proselytes, full Jews. What are those two issues? Circumcision, right? And that's a deal breaker. So they love the Jewish community, but they don't want to submit to this rite of circumcision. I mean, hello. That makes sense, right? Thank God the early church solved that one, because that would really add some confusion to our altar calls then, wouldn't it? Women over here, men over here. What's the second deal breaker? Dietary laws. Yeah, kosher laws. Yeah, they don't want to give up their pork. Good Filipinos, right? God prepared all this. Now here's what happens. The Apostle Paul and the apostles, when they go out into the Gentile world, when they go to their cities, where's the first place they go? They always go to the synagogue, because Paul said to the Jew first. The Jews, for the most part, reject the message. But now you think about this. You're a Gentile. You love this idea about one God. You love this community of people. You love moral uprightness and integrity. But you don't want a circumcision, and you certainly don't want to give up your pork. And this guy comes preaching this good news that you can get this one God. You can get a new community, a real family. You can get a real integrity. You don't have to be circumcised. You can eat all the pork you want. And this being is going to come and live on the inside of you. I mean, right. And so what's happening? Massive numbers of Gentiles are coming in the church. And you know what it's producing? Envy among the Jews. Because the Gentiles are leaving, and when people leave your church, what else leaves your church? Thank you. The tithes and offerings plummet. And so when you look at persecution in the New Testament, in almost every situation, what's behind the persecution? It's always money. It's always money. It's always about money. God prepared the church. God prepared the world for the advent of Christ. Give me some thoughts. Here's the application for us. God's still in the business of preparing the world for the moving of His Spirit. We apply these filters to our own current world. What's God doing in the Philippines to prepare the Philippines for His move? One of the things that's clear to me as an outsider is Filipinos, because of their nature, and just because of the whole political, what God's done, is no nations are intimidated by Filipinos. And so Filipinos can go places that Americans just can't go. That was God's providence. If you have a Filipino passport, you can go places as an American, you just can't go there. Filipinos can. And God prepared Filipinos to go and to take the gospel in the world. You know, I travel in every nation throughout our every nation world. And everywhere I go, there's Filipinos. You are omnipresent, yes. And I'm going to tell you this. This is not exaggeration. The Filipinos are the best church members, too. All over the every nation world. Everywhere I go. I just came from our Los Angeles church. 35% of our church is Filipino. And the Filipinos, they're your faithful, loyal church members. So God prepared the world for Filipinos. Nobody's intimidated. Come on in, Filipinos. And God's going to use Filipinos to change the world. Thank God. Let's finish. I got to go get some lunch. Let's come back at 1 o'clock and talk some more about various different things.